Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome into the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Got a really good show in store for you today. I read a very, very interesting book, not only over the weekend, but during the week, and I wanted to get to it. I had to wait for my eye to heal up first. I know you guys, I've been updating you on this really grody, and I use the word grody for the second time in 2 weeks. I haven't used that since the 80s, but now I'm using it again. Yes, I did have the equivalent of a chemotherapy shot to my eye for my retina. It doesn't hurt as much as you think it would, but it does hurt. There's some pain and pressure there for about 3 days. But it was my pleasure to get into this book, and I wanted to get into it as soon as I could. The name of the book is Shadow Man, an Elusive Psycho Killer and the Birth of FBI Profiling by Ron Francell. I want to get into it right away here. But first, I just want to mention that over the weekend, my littlest nephew, Gavin, was in a hockey tournament for Squirts. He's a hockey player, and they ended up winning the Squirts B Championship. They fought long and hard this season, and Gavin, I just want to say I love you. You did a good job, buddy, and congratulations on that championship. So let's get into this program, shall we? This novel, this book, folks, I was blown away by. If you're not familiar with the beginnings of the FBI profiling program, it's quite intensive. It's quite intriguing. And psychology is something that pulls me in. It's something that I myself am intrigued by, especially the psychology of the criminal mind. And this book really does bring it out. And in this case that happens in Manhattan, Montana, is one that really kind of boggles the mind, but at the same time brings out the very beginnings of what we now know as serial killers. That term wasn't, I believe, come up with until I think it was 1978, and we'll clarify that with our guest here. But let's bring him in without further ado. The author of Shadow Man, here is Ron Francell. Ron, welcome into True Crime Tuesday.
Hey, thank you, Tim. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start at the very beginning of this case. We start in 19, it was this 1970. Oh, actually, we're going to go back to the very beginning, of this. We should call him a serial killer because that's what he is. Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. We can refer to him as a serial killer as long as your listeners understand that that wasn't even a phrase. As you said, it wasn't, and that wasn't coined for several years after this. More importantly, the idea that a set of killings might be linked by the psychology or the psychopathy of the perpetrator hadn't really been fully developed either. So that plays a role here.
Now, it's kind of a complicated story in that, you know, we always hear that these killers start young, that it always starts with, I don't mean to laugh when I say this, but it starts with bedwetting, with killing a pet, something, and you would think this is cliche by now, but it always starts with a crime, something like this, or with a some sort of bad habit, and then it escalates from there. But it really does, sure. Doesn't it?
Well, it does. We certainly see certain behaviors that they're called, what you mentioned is called the McDonald triad. I should insert here that sure. the triad, the bedwetting, the cruelty to animals, a fascination with fire, has been, I don't know if discredited is the right word, but we've evolved past it psychologically. But certainly that was and remains a view of people like this. And even if we know a little different, it's at play in this particular story. And I think it does reflect on the kind of person that ultimately we're dealing with. But yeah, when our bad guy is 13 years old, there are a series of sort of deviant pet crimes, let's call them, in this little dinky town. And they were noticed by the cops. They just simply weren't accredited to some kind of deviant living among them. It was just believed that there were some teenagers being perversely cruel to animals as a kind of high school prank or something. And the animals were being nailed alive to telephone poles or burned alive, things like that. And it's wicked, of course, but the belief on part of the cops was just pranksters, deviant pranksters, but still just a teenage thing. There are other elements to those, the other pieces of those elements we just talked about, like the bedwetting. Of course, we don't know that for many more years down the line, but yeah, you're right. And it the story kind of begins there, but nobody knows it. And certainly we present it in the book in a kind of passing fashion, because we haven't, the really perverse stuff doesn't happen at that time. It's later in the story. But I think by the end of the story, all of these pieces line up.
They do. And you know what's interesting, Ron? The way you put this together in the book is very interesting in that we get snapshots. We get snapshots. We get a snapshot of the scene of a crime here, and then we get a snapshot of a scene of a crime here. And then you ask the question, so why does this keep coming up? Yeah. At the end of each chapter, which gets us thinking, why does this keep coming up? Tell me why that pneumatic trigger.
Well, I think that in general, that was a question I ran into a lot. I mean, we're talking about a set of crimes that happens 50 or more years ago. And it happens in a small town in the rural West, where people are suspicious to begin with of outsiders just sort of dropping in. You add the fact that outsider is asking troubling, somewhat embarrassing questions, then it gets ramped up. And it was a common question that was posed back to me while I was there. And I spent a lot of time boots on the ground in Manhattan and its environs. And the locals were not always welcoming. They didn't always open their doors, figuratively or literally. And that was a question. Well, why are you bringing this up? It also, I think, is a piece of the story that there is a reason why we're bringing it up. And of course, it's explained in there. We don't have time in this show to go into detail.
Right.
But there is a reason why 50 years we talk about this. If you ask me what drew you to this story 50 years later, my glib answer would be that the secret of my success as a writer is that I never pick up a story that I can screw up. And so I want a story. That's the glib answer. But what I really mean by that is that it has to have a certain power. It can't be formulaic. In this particular case, we're dealing with universal stuff like a mother's grief or the desperation and the persistence of the investigators and the FBI agents in this case. And maybe yours and my fear of the dark.
That's a good point. I want to ask you a little bit about the pushback when you put boots on the ground in Manhattan. There's two schools of thought here. School of thought number one is that so much time has passed that why would there be so much pushback? I mean, obviously, it's by now 50 years, you would think it would be ancient history. That maybe it wouldn't be such a shock to the system that you'd be able to walk in and be able to meet a generation or two down that wouldn't be as affected to talk about such events. Theory number two is that, well, we just want to move on. We just want to get past it. Why meet such resistance from the town? Is it that they just want to be that closed small community, that we just want to keep up the facade of being a small community?
Small towns have long memories, longer than big towns. In New York City, nobody would probably even remember this. Indeed, in New York City, nobody that I encountered knew about this case, part of the attraction to publishers. But the smaller the community, the longer the memory. And that's what's at work here. A small town anywhere it celebrates whatever positives it can. They call themselves the potato capital of the world. Can you imagine New York City declaring itself the potato capital or the strawberry capital or the, largest ball of string capital of the world? They don't, but small towns do, and they're grasping at any single thing that reflects well on them. The opposite is true, too. That any negative thing they're trying to hide it away. They're trying to put it in the attic, and they are individually embarrassed for their town, but also in small towns, the families and the descendants of these bad memories are still living there. And there's a sense that they owe more to the family who might be as much of a victim as the real victims, because they've suffered the accusations and the sidelong glances as anybody. So there are a lot of moving parts in that. Suffice it to say, when I drop into Manhattan, Montana, which is about 900 population, there's a significant number of people who feel that to talk about this case is to demean the town, which isn't true, of course. And a part of it is that this particular small town had no idea. And that's a little embarrassing, too. Shouldn't we live in a small town. We believe we know everybody. We believe we know why everybody does anything. We recognize the sound of your car driving down the street. You know, we know who has what vehicle. You introduce something and say, how is it you had no idea that you had a serial killer in your midst? And that's a difficult question for them to ask. So it's easier to say, why are you asking?
Well, I think it's fair to say, and closely bound doesn't mean closely knit. You know, I mean, how many times in our own families do we say we thought we knew somebody, but we didn't? You know, somebody has their own secret within a family, and much less a community. How can you know within a community that you might have a bad apple or a bad seed?
That's absolutely true, except that in a casual sense, they don't believe that. They believe they know everybody because they know their names. They could name any local resident walking down the street. So that kind of fools them into the illusion of knowing. And I say this not as a big city guy who's looking down his nose at the rural folks. I grew up in Wyoming in a small town. I know the landscape that I'm writing about here. Mm-hmm. I know the people that I'm writing about here, not by name, but by character.
Okay.
And so it's hard sometimes to convey that particular thing, and may not even be necessary to convey it. It's just that I understand that, and I understand how you can fool yourself into believing that you know when you don't.
I guess so. I kind of a different upbringing. You know, I was brought home to the city, and then we moved out to the suburbs, and then we lived out in the suburbs, you know, my entire life. So being a suburban kid, you know your block, but you don't know your entire city. So you do get kind of a mixture of the two, you know.
You do, yes.
You know, you know your block, you know your maybe even the block over, but you'll never truly know your city. So you're always instilled with the idea of a stranger is a stranger, so don't, you know, stranger danger, don't trust strangers, but you do trust the people on your block to look out for each other. At least that's the way it was in this time frame that we're talking about, which is the 70s and into the late 70s, which is kind of ironic. As I'm reading the novel, I'm thinking, you know, this is around the time that I was, you know, in my young childhood. And I'm thinking about, you know, I'm relating to one of the characters in the story, Susie, and being that young and thinking about, you know, how trusting the family is. And we'll get to Susie here in a little bit, as we go down the cases, of this one particular person that we'll get to as well. That's the central character of our story, in the serial killer in our story. But I'm just thinking, as I think this, and I'm putting myself in this novel, I'm thinking, you know, with small towns come the lack of heightened awareness or heightened security. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think they let their guard down to a certain degree for the reasons we were just talking, that I know everybody. I know who is a character. I know who's odd. I know who's friendly. And there's a sense that you would never transgress against people in a small town. You would be known immediately. There's also at play here a common idea that your town is an island, and that the seas that surround you might be rough. And in this particular time, early 70s, something happens, and there's an immediate reaction that it's the outside world. It's not one of us. It's the outside world. Manson's trial had ended, you know, very recently to this time. Watergate was ramping up. Vietnam was still raging, as well as the counterculture with it, the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, a few other perverse killers were out there. And so the people of Manhattan, Montana, felt that the world was imploding, and it had nothing to do with them. It had everything to do with that outside world. And that's where their mentality is when this happens.
Understandable. But then you look, you mentioned Manson, you look at them being put away, you know, their headquarters being in a faraway place, isolated, being out, you know, out in the outskirts. It seems to me that you would think, and I don't want to say small town people don't think this way, but if you want to talk about a worldly view put into a small town, I would think, even though you think you're isolated, and let me clarify my point here, Ron. Even though there's a false sense of security, we look after each other. We look, you know, we watch our backs. We know who comes in and goes. We have this sense of security. The first place, and we know this now through years and years of criminal profiling, the first place I would want to go if I'm a serial killer is to your neck of the woods, because you're isolated, because you've got a lot of land, because you've got places where I can hide bodies.
Sure.
You know, you're the first place I'm coming, not the last place I'm coming. Wouldn't
exactly.
You agree?
I would agree. And one of the themes of a few of my books that are set in the rural West is that the landscape is a kind of co-conspirator in this bad behavior. It not only allows the bad guys to hide themselves, but it gives them a place to hide their bodies. And it's the dark side of what is otherwise a very beautiful landscape. It just has this scary element to it. And again, this is at play in this story. And it shocks, I think, a lot of people. We're in reverse. The story here, in the way that it naturally uses the landscape and the surroundings, is a shock to the people in the cities on either coast, for example, how this could happen. And when I'm telling a story in the 1970s about Manhattan, Montana, or Gallatin County, Montana, I might as well be talking about a foreign land. And so that works in the favor of publishing and storytelling. But here it also struck me as maybe the landscape was kind of a character in the story. So it's presented in a sense that but this all unfolds on a stage that's rather austere and frightening.
I think the landscape very much is a character in this story. In fact, as I read this story, I can very much see it in my mind. It's very descriptive. You know, I was going to add, one of the things that shocked me, and I'm going to bring up a case that has nothing to do with the book, and that is the Jeffrey Dahmer case. One of the things that shocked me about the Jeffrey Dahmer case, he was caught in Milwaukee in a city, in a populated city. I mean, a lot of times, I shouldn't stereotype here, but when you hear of serial killers being caught, they aren't generally caught in populated cities, are they? You generally hear them running to somewhere remote and being caught. Or am I imagining things here?
I don't know. It's an interesting question about where a serial killer might be operating and what their prime hunting grounds might be. Certainly in cities, it's a target-rich environment.
Right.
They have more people, and they might have more situations where they can come into contact with potential victims. The farther you get out to these rural, less populated places, that the thing that changes is the exposure of that victim, the vulnerability of that potential victim, because they're driving across open spaces, or they find themselves alone in a city, in a town park, or on the edge of town, or wherever. It doesn't necessarily change the victimology, and that's the view of a non-forensic psychologist, but I don't think that if we studied serial killers and where they come from, that it would be vastly different from the ratio of city people to rural people.
Okay.
They exist in all populations. In this case, somebody from among those people, not a city person, but somebody who was one of them. And there's a certain security of operating among the people that you come from. You can imagine, you don't want to stand out. You don't want to be the obvious New Yorker in Manhattan, Montana. You also don't want to be the obvious Montana cowboy on Fifth Avenue.
True, very true. Ron, let's do this. Let's take our break. When we come back, let's talk about the players in this case and who eventually gets shooken out as the one who ties in between each one of these cases and eventually is sniffed out as the person who committed these crimes. The book is Shadow Man, and an elusive psycho killer and the birth of FBI profiling. Ron Francella is our guest. He's the author of the book Shadow Man, an elusive psycho killer and the birth of FBI profiling. You can click on the link in the description of the show and follow that and get a copy of the book today. It's again a fascinating book and a very enticing book. I got through it. It's such an easy read. I breezed right through it. And a very intriguing book at that. When we come back, we'll talk about the crimes, the players, and who eventually shook out as the suspect. We'll do that when we come back next on the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to True Crime Tuesday. This is Tim Dennis. Our guest is Ron Francell. The book is Shadow Man, an elusive psycho killer and the birth of FBI profiling. Ron Francell, our guest. Ron, let's jump into it here. Now, we alluded to the fact that when you're setting up the book, when you're getting into the beginning of the book, you start to highlight a few cases, and then you tie
yeah,
it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and then you kind of start to tie it together as we introduce not just our local our local policemen who are looking into it. But then the eventual involvement of the FBI. But let's go over a little bit. Now, you talk at first about two kids playing on a bridge. And one of the kids is up on I believe on a bridge about to jump down into the water. He's about to about to do some sort of a stunt. What happens to this child as he gets up on the bridge? He's about to do a stunt. It's something unusual.
They're literally out in the edge of town. Nobody's around. Dirt roads leading, you know, to and from the bridge. But they're doing what kids do in rural places. They're going out on a warm day and having fun. In this case, jumping off a bridge into the river below, the Gallatin River. In this particular case, and at some point in their play, one of them goes up to the very top of the bridge, this steel girder bridge, and is about to jump off when he turns to his friend on the ground and said, "I'm shot." And he then just sort of tumbles off the bridge into the water below. As he's carried down the river, the friend doesn't know what to do, so he runs to the nearest habitation, which is a farm about a mile away. They call the sheriff. The sheriff comes out, but then they can't find this little boy's body. It's attributed at that time by the investigators from the sheriff's department that it was a stray shot. Somebody had been hunting rabbits or target practicing and either missed their target or ricocheted, and it just happened to hit this kid. And that's where it was left. His body was ultimately found about 3 weeks later, and they did indeed find that he'd been shot in the chest. The theory remained that this was an accidental death from a stray bullet.
And this happened in what year? Was it in the 60s?
Yeah, that was 1967, the spring of 1967.
Okay. So then there's also an incident in the state park, right? Having to do with a Boy Scout?
It does, and it's about a year later. There's a Boy Scout camporee, a gathering of all the troops in the area to camp in a particular park, in this case, a state park called Headwaters, where the Missouri forms as two other rivers come together. And there's a small park there. There were about 300 Boy Scouts crammed into this park that's no more than 3 acres. They are camped in pup tents, two guys to a pup tent, and not more than 4 or 5 feet apart all over the park, plus their scout masters and troop leaders. One of those tents, two boys, one of them wakes up in the morning and his tent mate is bleeding and unresponsive. He's, you know, raises an alarm. People come. They examine the kid. He's been stabbed in his sleeping bag. They take him, of course, to the nearest hospital, and a couple days later, he dies. An autopsy finds he didn't die of the stab wound, but of a bludgeoning of some kind. Again, the belief of the sheriff's department, same sheriff's department, is that these kids were playing rough that afternoon, the afternoon before. That this boy fell or was hit, during this roughhousing, and ultimately, you know, suffered brain damage that killed him. Every Boy Scout, of course, carries a knife. And in this camp, there are at least 300 knives. So as a matter of fact, they even give a lie detector test to every one of those boys, and they find no significant culpability, and they move on with the idea that this boy had been killed, or his death was the result of roughhousing that the teenage boys do. He was 12. All of those scouts were between 10 and 13. So, again, we chalk it up to an unfortunate accident, which is important in the context that we were talking about earlier. Nothing serious happens in a small town, or at least this one.
Right.
And that it couldn't be murder. That was kind of dismissed very quickly. Mm-hmm. There had to be another explanation.
You would think, and you're right. Yeah. With the bump on the head and everything, sure, you can write it off to, you know, horseplay, and that's exactly what they did. But then we fast forward to 1973 at that Headwaters State Park in Montana. And a family from Michigan is camping at that park. And yes, it's at that point, and it's the Yeager family. And at that point, little Heidi Yeager, who's only 12 years old, feels a breeze inside their tent.
Yes. The night before, four of the siblings had crammed into this tent, kind of snuggled up like sardines in their sleeping bags. So crammed in there, so to speak. Heidi wakes up the next morning and feels this breeze on her face, which is unusual. And she sees that the back of the tent is open, and she assumes it has split or something. But she also notices that her little sister, 7-year-old Susie, is gone. Her first belief is that Susie has just, you know, wandered out to go to the bathroom or is playing outside or something. It's 5 o'clock in the morning, so playing seems unusual, but she's a 12-year-old girl. She doesn't know. She goes out and tries to find Susie and can't find her, so it alerts her parents. And pretty soon the whole family is up kind of searching around for Susie, and slowly other campers in the park are helping to search. But Susie's gone. So they call the sheriff's department, again, same sheriff's department, to come out and investigate. A deputy arrives. One of the things he notices is a circular slit in the tent right where Susie's head would be. He also sees a faint trail of footprints through the dewy grass toward a nearby parking area. That is the sum total of the evidence they have. At that point, believing that they had a case of foul play, the FBI is called in because federal law demands in a kidnapping that the FBI be involved, or kidnapping like this, that the FBI be involved. So the FBI arrives on the scene. By that time, even the track through the dewy grass is gone. They have no witnesses. They have no evidence beyond a slit in the tent. And they begin what would become the largest manhunt in Montana history, with more than 1,000 people out literally beating the bushes looking for this little girl. But they come up empty. And for the next few days, then weeks, then months, the FBI and local law enforcement have nothing. They're flat-footed. They're frustrated, but they have nothing.
And that's where Agent Pete Dunbar comes in, and he starts taking over the case and starting to figure out what exactly they have. Takes a description and really gets to know the family, and in particular starts to bond a little bit with Marietta, who's the mother, correct?
Yes. And you it's important to know that Pete Dunbar is the agent on the scene within hours after this disappearance is known. He is from there. He's from that area. He had worked as an FBI agent in the big cities and been respected. But when his parents grew old and ill, he asked to be sent back to this rural Montana area so that he could watch his parents. So he's from there. In fact, his ancestors had actually donated the land on which this park sat. He knew these people. He knew the place. He was as frustrated, maybe more than anybody, about what has just happened and how they had nothing. He dedicates himself to this, but he is completely stymied until something else happens. And I guess we'll get into that.
We will get into that. To say Pete wasn't impressed with the police work from time to time would be understating it, wouldn't it?
Yes. And not just Pete, but the people of the county, they do recall that Boy Scout's death. And they do recall that it seemed like a casual investigation that didn't really lay the blame at anybody's feet. So their conclusion was that it was botched by the sheriff's office. And so there was a political element on the sheriff's part. He if he were to be reelected, he needed to overcome some of these suspicions. And now all of a sudden, a little girl goes missing and he can't find her. Yes, you're right. Pete Dunbar, the FBI agent, lacks confidence in his local law enforcement partners.
And it makes his search even that much worse. I mean, as far as trying to find a suspect. How long did the Yeagers search in that area, in that state park? I mean, it had to be quite a while. They were there for how long?
They were there for quite a while, weeks, I think 6 weeks. And the locals were so kind and generous. They supplied food. They visited. Dunbar even arranged for his local parish priest to visit the family and not only counsel them, but, you know, to share share with them some fellowship. So, but again, I guess it's important. There's nothing. We still have nothing. A lot of tips have poured in. They tend to fall into the category of it's somebody from outside. And so they were reporting every long-haired guy that traveled through the county in his Volkswagen and every dirty little kid that came through with hippie families or tourist families that didn't look right. But very little pointing at people inside. There was some, but not much by comparison.
So there's also at this time a little bit into 1974. There's a girl named Siobhan McGinnis who goes missing as well, isn't there?
There is, and she's a little five-year-old girl from a town up the road, Missoula, Montana, a bigger city, a college town. But this little five-year-old girl goes missing in broad daylight, and there's, again, a big search for her. They find nothing for a while, and some days later they find her dead in a culvert out on the highway. She's been stabbed and molested. I hate to sound like a broken record, but they have no suspects either. Maybe today we would make certain deductions about somebody who would snatch a little girl off a city street where she lives in broad daylight. Mm-hmm. And take her out to a specific place on the road and stuff her body in a culvert underneath the highway. Back then, there was none of that kind of deduction going on in a serious way.
In a little bit around that same time in 1974, you'll have to clarify Sandy's last name again for me.
Sandy Smalligan.
Smalligan, okay. She was Sandy Dykeman before she got married, but someone who doesn't really fit the MO here. She was 19 years old, correct, at the time of her death?
Yes, exactly.
She had just, I guess you could say she was newly separated, never divorced, but separated, right, from her husband?
Correct. She and her husband, another local guy, had separated. They both married very young, and it just didn't work out, so they separated. He's still in the town. She's taken a job as a waitress at the local cafe. She's known everybody. You know, we're going back to our original conversation, but right. Yep. Everybody goes to the cafe, and she's very friendly. Everybody knows she was a good student at the high school. She's pretty. Everybody knows her. When she goes missing, this is pretty big news in the town. She wasn't the kind of girl who would just wander off on her own. Of course, she was recently separated, and some suspicion fell on her estranged husband. There were a few others. She'd begun dating during that time, so there were other people. But as they're investigating the human side, they're also looking for her. And as the search, unsuccessful search, expands in an ever-widening circle around Manhattan, they find a couple deputies find themselves searching an abandoned ranch homestead out in the middle of nowhere, maybe a half an hour's travel from Manhattan, when they find her car hidden in a dilapidated barn, covered over with all kinds of things. At that point, obviously, there's an immediate search of the place. And as they look closer and closer, they find on the ground, shattered, pulverized pieces of bone, charred and scattered as if the wind had taken them. As they collect all of this that they can and send it off to the Smithsonian, as the FBI did at that time, the Smithsonian gets back fairly quickly and says these are indeed bones from a young female, late teens, early 20s. And at that point, they knew they probably had Sandy Smalligan's remains, and somebody had literally pulverized her bones, which appeared to be burned, and scattered them so they wouldn't be found. But, says the Smithsonian, there are also among these bones the bones of a much younger female, under 10 years old. At that point, for the very first time, the two cases of Susie Yeager and Sandy Smalligan become entangled in the minds of the FBI.
Can I stop you for a second, Ron? And we'll continue with that thought in just a second here. Can you, for our younger listeners, can you tell them why those bones went to the Smithsonian and why every police department didn't have a crime lab that could analyze that at the time?
Well, just that. I mean, we've got to remember that in 1974, our forensic tools, the forensic tools available to police were some primitive blood typing and fingerprints. Lie detectors were being used a little bit more, but that's where it stopped. Mm-hmm. And there was no such thing as the computer databases we have now, certainly not DNA, which is more than a decade away. And there are a variety of other high-tech tools that we now take for granted today that didn't exist. They sent it to the Smithsonian because that was, at least to federal agents, the most trustworthy and knowledgeable center for the study of bones. In this case, it was anthropological more than it was forensic anthropological.
So they pulled this evidence from the Lockhart Ranch of and found bone fragments they believed to be both Sandy's and Susie's.
Exactly. And they now believe that they have one killer or one team of killers involved in both girls' disappearances. Things, at least in terms of the fact that there are suspects, or not suspects, but perpetrators out there connected to both cases, but they had no, still, 8 months after Susie disappeared, they still had no suspects because they had no evidence, no witnesses, no leads. And they were as frustrated as they had ever been, because now they have something far more different, far different than what they had dealt with before. And for a few months, Dunbar is frustrated beyond belief. It's not until he has to return to Quantico in Virginia to get some ordinary, regularly scheduled training, that he sits in on a workshop by two fellow agents. One is a psychology expert named Pat Mullaney. The other is one of the FBI's respected crime scene. He was an agent who was known to be expert at crime scenes. He wasn't a crime scene tech.
Okay.
These two guys had an idea, and they were developing the notion that crime scene evidence might tell investigators a lot about behavior and the psychology of the perpetrator if they knew what to look for. And if they knew that everything they saw could tell them something about their unknown subject, their unsub. So half of Shadow Man is about the crimes, and the other half is about how these two kind of pioneering FBI agents conceived this first profile. In this case, after that workshop, Dunbar follows them down into their basement offices at the training academy and tells them about the case of Susie Yeager and of Sandy Smalligan, and confesses that he has nothing, and could they help? They took a look at his case file and ultimately decided that this case was not very complicated nor high stakes. It was a safe bet. It might be a safe one to test their theory. So this is where the FBI's first criminal profile is born.
What's interesting, and one of the things you point out in the book is, I believe the other gentleman's name was Teton, right? His last name?
Teton, yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. So Mulaney and Teton get together, and they sit down with Pete Dunbar. And as they're going over these two cases, normally in today's criminal profiling, it takes, especially with serial killers, it takes five cases in order to figure out a profile for a serial killer. They did it with two cases, and they, as they profiled this killer, correct?
Exactly. But once again, we have to remember there's no roadmap. They have no rule book to follow. They are doing this for the first time. There wasn't much trust in it. J. Edgar Hoover himself thought profiling was hokum. It was black magic. It was only the death of Hoover and the ushering in of more progressive leadership at the FBI that gave these two guys a little bit longer leash to prove their theory. But it's not known at that time. It hasn't really been formulated at that time that the serial nature of these crimes, the connection among them. So they're, to a certain degree, they don't have that kind of perspective yet. They had certain beliefs based on a few interviews that they had done with known killers, and certain things that they had deduced from that. But that was all. They didn't have those databases. So there was most of this was experience and logic. I think even they would admit that a little bit of it was guesswork. But again, they were separately experts in psychology and crime scenes and had no model. And most of the items on their profile ultimately were just came from their own backgrounds.
I think it's safe to say, though, it was a pretty good educated guess. I mean, like you said, there was precedent, there was experience. And when you look back at the hundreds of crimes that are out there, of murders that are out there that were committed by psychopathic personalities, you could see patterns and match those to interviews you had done with psychopathic killers and then put those together along with psychological trends and kind of squeeze that all into an uncomfortable box. And there you go. You've got a loose recipe to make your little psychopathic cake with, I guess, to put it kind of non-eloquently. In theory, it works. And in theory, it does work because we still use it today. Although not in the way people think. I mean, there's TV shows out there that kind of overdo it and make it look. Make it look a little different than what it actually is.
Yeah, Hollywood has a tendency to overdo it in spectacular ways.
Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is throughout the book, Mulaney and Teton, they're giving Pete interesting directions, even though there are times where they doubt themselves, don't they? They say to themselves, "Well, we think this is where he's going, but we're not quite sure ourselves."
Well, there was an element of that, yes. That because they had no roadmap, they had no database, they had no significant number of interviews that they had done with killers, they would admit there was a little guesswork involved, not as much as you might think. But the pushback was more from boots on the ground law enforcement. Cops and even agents like Dunbar, just as Hoover had pushed back. And the reason is because they believed a crime was solved by talking to people, by knocking on doors, and maybe a little Sherlockian deduction. But that was fell far short of the kind of carnival sideshow mind reading and clairvoyance that they believed profiling was. So there was conflict more than Teton and Mulaney questioning themselves. They were being questioned by the boots on the ground.
Now, at one point, the net was cast pretty wide as far as suspects went. It was every serial pervert you could think of, sex pervert, to people who were oddballs in town, to whoever it may be. They narrow that down to, I believe it was a handful, correct, that they had in mind?
That's the nature of profiling. People think that profilers jump on a private plane and go to the crime scene and do their voodoo and then whip out their guns and chase the bad guys and throw them down and slap the cuffs on them. That's not what happens. These guys were simply trying to narrow the pool of suspects so that the boots on the ground law enforcement could narrow its energy and its time to people who are more likely to have committed the crime, away from people who are less likely or could no way have committed the crime. So that was their function, was to simply narrow the pool of possibilities. And so, yes, they start with a wider cast net, and then that net slowly gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And along the way, you know, their first profile was about 15 items. By the time this this investigation happened, comes to a conclusion, they've added a few because they've learned some things along the way. Mm-hmm. So it's roughly 20 elements in this profile, which we know now, 19 of them were spot on.
Right.
And that 20th one wasn't wrong. It's just that the circumstances of the case made it that we could never get that question answered.
Well, and as far as actual people, they had cast a wide net as well. And I know in Sandy's case, they were looking at her ex-husband, former boyfriends, people she had dated. And then what's funny is things kind of come out in the wash when they're eliminating suspects in town. And as you're pointing out, profile, and we're kind of intersecting here, Ron, with what you just said there and what I'm about to say here, is as Mulaney and Teton are coming up with profiles and behaviors and what this person may look like and what this person may possess as far as characteristics go in a profile, something matches everything in this profile of this person that probably killed Susie and probably killed everyone else that we've listed to Siobhan, to the Boy Scout in the tent. And they're pretty specific profile characteristics, aren't they?
Well, they are. And we must remember, your listeners should know that nobody has mentioned the two young boys from 67 and 68 as being related. In fact, they're not even really remembered. Siobhan McGinnis isn't really a factor either. They are just looking at the two cases of Susie and Sandy. And yes, the profilers come up with some fairly specific things. Some of them we now know today are kind of the go-to descriptions, that it's probably a white male in his 20s. You and I and everybody else kind of presume that's the typical serial killer and mass murderer, not 100%, but that's the go-to description. And things like Susie was probably dead within 2 days. But they also went beyond that. They said, for example, that the unsub was probably at least modestly intelligent, because Susie's kidnapping needed a highly organized thinker who really had anticipated what the investigators would do. So there was a lot of planning and organization, and a dumb guy wasn't going to be able to do that. He took her to an off-site location. He could have just dumped her, which he didn't, and it would have been easier. So he had what they presumed to be a stronger, more developed, detailed fantasy about this. He was able to move around in the dark. He probably drove an inconspicuous vehicle nobody would think twice about. He knew exactly where to park and how to move around in the dark. All of those things said something to them about his personality. So that's where I say there's a certain amount of logic and experience involved.
There's only one problem with the number one suspect that kept coming up. He's a fine, upstanding young citizen.
Yes. He's come up once before during the Susie Yeager investigation. He's now coming up again as somebody who had dated Sandy Smolligan one time. It didn't work out. She kind of brushed off a lot of his continued efforts to get a second date. So they looked at him, they even talked to him. But the fact is, he was fairly articulate. He was modestly smart. He was friendly. He dressed well. He had no record of any kind. He was recently back from Vietnam, a Marine sergeant. He just did not fit the profile that they had been given.
Dunbar
was making a gut reaction. This couldn't possibly be our guy. He didn't look like a killer, and he didn't sound like a killer. And no matter what the profilers were saying, that he did fit the profile, we go back to that idea that the boots on the ground were pushing back, that they didn't buy into this entirely. And Dunbar would say, they never came out here. They never talked to him. I've talked to him twice, and he's not our guy. He pops up again. And the profilers are even stronger about this. They suggest that Dunbar suggests as a way to put them, to quiet them, that they take him and give him a lie detector test, which they do. He passes. Subsequent to that, the profilers want to do it again. He passes again a second time. Eventually, the profilers suggest a truth serum test for this guy. Again, he passes with flying colors, and his story hasn't wavered one iota.
Which is amazing. I mean, even under truth serum, but we know now that even under truth serum, it can alter your brain state. It can alter your story. Being under the influence of that stuff can actually alter your story to a point where it's not truthful. And it's a narco testimony is not necessarily a good testimony.
Well, and there was also belief at that time that a true psychopath was wired differently from the rest of us. And since these kinds of tests, particularly polygraph, measured your body's reaction to certain questions, If he were wired differently, he'd be able to possibly give lies as answers that would be registered as truth. We know now that's not true. We know now that you and I have the same chances of passing a lie detector test or failing as a psychopath. But at the time, there was that belief. It really comes down more to the quality of the machine, the quality of the questions, the ability of the examiner to do this. But in any case, at the moment in 1974, when he's given three separate lie detection tests, and he passes them all with essentially the same story in every case, Dunbar is convinced they don't have the right guy. They just don't. And the profilers, on the other hand, are convinced that he's on the right trail of the right guy. So again, conflict going on among the law enforcement while that net that you describe is slowly tightening.
And at that point, they really do need to dig deeper. There's a last ditch effort to dig deeper to try and find more evidence, because the first time they're out at the Lockhart Ranch, it was kind of a surface search, wasn't it?
No, certainly. I mean, literally, they're crawling along the surface of this kind of dead ground and picking up pieces of a human. The profilers, though, one of the elements of their profile is that the person who committed this crime, they saw in the evidence that this unsub would personalize this. This wasn't just a quickie, let's kill somebody and move on. That he would personalize it. It would be an intimate crime, and as such, he might celebrate anniversaries, just as you and I celebrate a birthday or an anniversary. He might pick an anniversary important to these crimes and reach out to the family, because in a sense, he considered himself a part of the family. And the profilers and Dunbar agreed to put a tap on the family's family phone back in Michigan, thinking that if he does call, he will call them and it will be that anniversary. Indeed, at the very minute of the abduction of Susie Yeager 1 year before, their phone rings. And it is a man who claims to have taken Susie, and in the process talks about a particular physical deformity of the little girl that Marietta, her mother, had never even mentioned to the FBI. It was never published anywhere because the FBI didn't even know it. They were as surprised as anyone. But it proved that they were talking to Susie's abductor. In that phone call, he begins as a kind of sadistic, taunting figure who's twisting the knife over and over and over. And here's this mother who's sick at heart, who's grieving, who's convinced that she's talking to a man who killed her daughter, partly because the profilers believed Susie had been dead from only a few hours after she disappeared. So part of her believed Susie was dead. Another part of her wanted to believe there was a possibility she wasn't. Now she's talking to the guy who had taken her daughter, and she stood in there. She wasn't angry or accusatory or hysterical. She stood in there asking questions like a mother would. Mm-hmm. They were straightforward, and she kept him on the line. It wasn't the tracing of the phone call, which was as important, ultimately. It was what he said that added to and expanded the knowledge that the profilers had about this unsub.
Now, there was, as you pointed out, she stayed strong and continued to talk to this caller. And there was more than one call, obviously. There were a few calls in there.
Yes.
He continued to try to torture her, get on top. There was a seesaw battle, if you will, between the two at one point. And there was the backup of Mulaney and Teton telling, almost coaching, I guess, along with Pete Dunbar, coaching Marietta to keep her on top of this killer, to try and keep him at bay, because they found a fatal flaw in him, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And in that phone call we were just talking about, that taunting, that sadism that we saw in the beginning, by the end of the phone call, he has been reduced to a tremble. He's starting to sob. And the reason the profilers believed was that he had some difficulty with strong women. She was standing in there with him. She wasn't crumpled on the floor. She wasn't hysterical. And that frustrated his intentions. So there was a presumption that a strong woman would throw him off his game. And so, yes, they continued to involve her in this communication. They, at one point, ultimately, they take her to Montana and put her in his presence, hoping that she'll be able to get under his skin a little bit more. The confrontation doesn't produce that, but she is able to look him in the eye and tell him that she knows he did it. And he ultimately doesn't react openly to that, but the profilers believe she made, she threw him off balance. From that moment forward, he's under 24/7 surveillance by the FBI and by local cops. Openly, they want him to know they're watching him. At one point, he even walks up to one of the vehicles and asks if he can have a ride to a nearby town, because he knows he's going to town and he knows they would follow him. And he just told him that it made no sense to take two vehicles. Let's just go in yours. He maintained he was innocent, and he believed he was harassed and being persecuted unfairly, or at least said that openly, and hired a lawyer who believed that too.
There comes a time, or there comes a breaking point, where they believe they have enough on this man to bring him in.
They're close. They believe that now he's probably their guy. What? When another phone call comes to Marietta Yeager. And in this phone call, which they ultimately trace to a motel in Salt Lake City, he puts on a little girl and tells her, Marietta, that it's Susie. Marietta can't recognize the voice, but the little girl speaks and says something like, he's a nice man, mommy, I like him, something to that effect. At that point, the FBI sets aside the probability that they have the right guy and decides that he might have another girl and that they can't afford to wait. So that's when they move in and they make an arrest.
I'm trying to decide how much I want to leave our listeners with. We'll put it this way. We haven't mentioned the fact that our killer does have a lawyer. We'll put it to you this way. Our killer is arrested and he's brought in. We'll leave it at that. At this point, Ron, I think I want to leave people to the book because I think there are some twists and turns in there.
Suffice it to say, yes, upon his arrest are some of the more deviant, freakish things that happen in this book. And this book has a lot of deviant, freakish things up to this point.
Yeah.
But some of the most stuff is revealed after his arrest. And really, the book it leaves us with a message about serial killers. Again, they weren't called the serial killers, but it leaves us with some sense of the beginning of this whole fascination we today have with those kinds of people.
I'll tell you, and I'll tell the audience, Ron, the reason why I hold back so much and why I'm going to hold back so much is because the end of this book is so rich, and we've left out some really good detail about what's found at the ranch and that second search, what's found at the ranch. The search of our killer's home is particularly rich with detail.
Yes, it is.
And the gotcha of what they find in order to nail down our killer is pretty amazing.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm not, after 17 previous books, I'm not easily surprised or shocked or even sickened by anything. As I found out this information, I was surprised. I was shocked. And maybe a little sickened. It's beyond imagination, even if you and I are at this moment leaving it to the imagination of readers and listeners. But I don't know how we can reveal it without spoiling the whole story.
Yeah, exactly. You do get a wrap-up, a really nice wrap-up of where everybody ends up. Which is, I think, satisfying. I think a lot of books don't do that, Ron. And I was really appreciative of being able to see where everybody ends up at the end of the book, which was really nice. It was really nice detail. And even an afterword that I thought was really intriguing as well. So I really, really enjoyed this book. I can't stress it enough, and I want everybody in our audience to go out and get a copy of Shadow Man. It's intriguing just to see the beginnings of FBI profiling and criminal profiling, and the psychology. If you're a fan of the psychology of serial killers and the psychology and the beginnings of that, how they began FBI profiling and getting into a criminal's head, because This first case is intriguing to say the least. This guy had his stuff together until he became unraveled. Then he really didn't unravel, did he, Ron?
No. Well, and so much of his psychopathy was about control.
Yeah.
That when they slapped the cuffs on him, he's lost control. He's lost control over the next thing that's going to happen. It's only then subsequent to that that he decides to take back control.
Yeah. The book is Shadow Man, an Elusive Psycho Killer and the Birth of FBI Profiling. The author is Ron Francell. We will have, and we do have, a link to the book in the description of this program. Folks, you will love this book. This book is amazing. The end will give you chills. I'll tell you that much. And I'll tell you this much. There's a little twist at the end. You're just going to go, oh, no. Just for that little twist at the end of the book alone, it's well worth the price. So, Ron, I want to thank you very much for joining us here on True Crime Tuesday.
Thank you, Tim, for having me. I truly appreciate it.
And I appreciate it as well. All right, it's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.